Welcome to Turning Pages, a series of in-depth conversations with authors about their works.
All right, well, his book explaining the mysteries of octopuses, Many Things Under a Rock, is out through Norton and Company. David Scheel joins me by phone to discuss it. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. So I want to start with the fact that, like, when I first started this book, I didn't realize there was going to be a thing about, you know, indigenous languages, and the fact that the title is drawn from a description of octopus through, you know, one of the Alaskan indigenous population's word for it. I'm curious about kind of, you know, your learning experience on the topic of language and descriptions of octopus through this, you know, research and through your studies. Like, it's a fascinating part of this, I thought.
Yeah, it really is. That came about, that the word is, and I apologize to Alaskan or indigenous native listeners who maybe know how to pronounce this, because I always butcher it, but the word itself is Salaxguk, and it's an Eyak word. And when I first moved to Cordova, you know, you begin to learn a little bit about the local area and everything. And Cordova is the home area of the Eyak people. And when I arrived there, there was one Eyak native speaker left in the world, Marie Smith, and she lived in Cordova. And so this, you know, as you become aware of this, this becomes kind of you know, it's amazing how many dialects and languages are sort of dying out in the world, and this is a thing that is you know, sort of well known in Alaska, and it has a long and unfortunate history. But any rate, I kind of became a little bit interested in that. And then I was traveling up in Fairbanks, and I thought, well, why not stop in at the Alaska Native Language Center there in Fairbanks, Alaska? And I had this wonderful conversation with the scholars there. And one of the things that I was amazed to note is some of the parallels between how language evolves and moves around the world and biological evolution. And, you know, I came to this as an evolutionary biologist, but it was just very interesting to me. And Salaxguk translates as sort of a bunch of things under a rock, and or many things under a rock. And I thought that was just such an evocative image for octopuses. And then over the years that I've been working with octopuses, it just seems like the biology of this animal connects to so many different things that there was another sort of metaphor for the octopus, of just this breadth of connections that the animal makes to different aspects of the world.
Yeah, it's kind of fascinating, because the title, when I first read it, I thought, you know, like when you lift up a rock, you know, things scurry out and stuff, right? Like that's the traditional kind of like notion of, you know, like the plant life and natural life that happens kind of underneath a rock. And then not knowing that it was drawn from a specific word and translation for octopus, I was like, oh, that's a really fascinating thing. You were mentioning about kind of the dying out of indigenous languages in Alaska. It runs a parallel track to a lot of like your work on, you know, climate impacts, right? That there are, you know, species and environs that are dying out in parallel to these indigenous populations and their language histories.
Yeah, you know, climate change is going to have, or is already having, a big effect on the world, and it's going to shift ranges, move things around, reshuffle communities, you know, and some things will die out. And I write a little bit about, you know, sort of our ability to measure the effects of climate change on octopuses in the book. And, you know, we've already seen in North Pacific waters that these particular octopuses seem to become less abundant following warmer years, which is, you know, not an optimistic sign for what the future is like or will be like.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You talk about, is it Cornwall in England?
Yeah, yes, it is. Southern England. This is a fascinating story. In Southern England, in 1900 and 1950, both, the south coast of England experiences these sort of swarms of octopuses that come to the beaches, and fishermen can't collect anything else. And there's so many octopuses that if you use octopus for bait, you just catch more octopuses. And they piled up on the shores. And this was just fascinating to me, in part because it was such an extreme event, but also in part because it paralleled these fascinating stories from, I think they were from BC, of indigenous villages being attacked by swarms of octopuses, and or First Nations villages, sorry. And I was just kind of intrigued by the literary parallel, if you will, of these things, one in these almost forgotten scientific records, and the other in these almost forgotten legends. And in the scientific records, the 1950 swarm seems to have been the result of warming. And it's kind of intriguing how, in one place, Southern England, an abnormally warm winter might result in an increase in octopuses. And in other places like the North Pacific, abnormally warm winters would result in a decrease. And I think this comes about because, in England at least, this is a slightly warmer water octopus, the Zoctopus vulgaris, the common octopus in the Atlantic. And it's the northern edge of its range is normally, or has historically been, South England, the very, very southern England. And as the waters warm up, conditions in southern England become favorable, and the octopus sort of has this spike in abundance into the English Channel. And in the future, it may reach up, well north of England, as the climate's warm. Whereas in Alaska, Alaska is the northern edge of a cold water species. And the species is adapted to cold water. And so when we see, and in cold oceans, cold water normally means there's good mixing from the bottom. We have a lot of productivity, a lot of nutrients in the water. And in a productive ocean, we get a lot of octopuses. And then when it warms up, my surmise is that we get more stratification, we get less mixing, less nutrients from the bottom, less productivity. In a less productive ocean, the octopuses grow more slowly because they're less to eat, and their predators are more hungry because there's less to eat. And so then the smaller, slower growing octopuses are more vulnerable, and overall, we get fewer octopuses when it's warm here in the north.
Yeah, it really points to kind of the intricate and interwoven nature of these things that, some benefit from and some certainly see a decrease in terms of, or like are more threatened by these kinds of climate change impacts. I want to talk about your, path to studying octopus, because it sounds like in the book that you didn't necessarily anticipate that this is exactly what you'd spend your time doing, that you kind of fell into it in a way. Am I reading that right in the way you describe things?
Yes, that's exactly right. I recently thought I should liken this to standing on the shore on a small ledge at low tide over a tide pool. And that's how I came to study octopuses. I fell in. I arrived in Cordova to work with the Prince William Sound Science Center there because I had good skills in geographic information systems, which is a software program for mapping. And when I was a graduate student at the University of Minnesota, I actually studied mammals and predators in Africa. And at the end of my tenure there, as I was getting ready to graduate, my advisor said to me, "You should take a course in GIS, geographic information systems. You need a marketable skill." Which was his way of saying that the future looks bleak, dude. Do something useful. And so I took that course, and he was right. My first two jobs were connected to having that skill. And so I ended up in Cordova, and then I realized the position I'd been hired on was what in the business we call soft money. That is, it was a single year of funding. And after that, I would have to raise my own salary by getting research grants. So I became very energetic in trying to raise money. And in the next subsequent few years, I think I had 5 different projects going at once. And I would spend 3 months of the year working on each of them and squeeze the 5th one into the cracks.
I was going to say that math doesn't add up, but yes. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. And it was exhausting. But out of those 5 projects, the only one to survive very long term has been this octopus research, and that became my career.
So the GIS led you there, but it was in such a way like an open-ended kind of thing, and an understanding of information systems that wasn't specific to any animal or any place, so that you could apply it, and you just found this application with the octopus study.
Yeah, the skill set was really just in this software program that does mapping, and you use mapping in ecology. I did a lot of work on killer whales, creating a spatial database for the movements of killer whales. I used the mapping software for that, and I created some maps for the Science Center of slopes and data from the ocean. So it's basically a way to place data into its spatial context. And it's a very powerful software. It's still around today. It's the most frequently used mapping software, I suppose. But I didn't keep my skill set current because my training ultimately was in behavioral ecology. And so my passion was to work with animal behavior. So that was the kind of projects that I looked for ways to latch onto.
So the GIS provided the into the octopus, and then you were able to apply the like core skill set of the behavioral ecology.
Exactly. Yeah.
Speaking of skill sets, diving, had you been a diver prior to ending up on this initial project, or was that something you had to, get PADI certification once you realized this was something you wanted to do?
I was a certified scuba diver at the time. I had done exactly the 4 dives that are required to gain certification and no more. I had an incident with a small boat when I was a child on Lake Erie, and it left me with a distaste for the water. And so I never really set out to become a marine biologist. And I took this scuba diving course in Minnesota in order to a buddy of mine said, "Hey, you want to try and learn scuba diving?" And I was like, "All right." So I took a scuba diving course with a buddy of mine, and I was petrified to draw breath underwater. In the scuba diving course, they put you on scuba gear, you sit at the bottom of a pool, and you just breathe to learn, the skills. And it just scared the heck out of me. And I was so nervous breathing underwater that I would sort of gulp in the air and every breath and go, "Oh, I'm not dead." And then I would exhale, and the whole cycle would repeat on the next breath. And so I was holding on to a subsurface platform in Box Lake, Minnesota, right after the ice went out, on my first scuba dive, just anchored to the floor and holding on with a death grip, doing all the skill sets that you have to practice. And then at the end of that training dive, we let go and we swam around a little bit, after the skills were all demonstrated. And as soon as I let go of the platform, I could not control my buoyancy, which is very common in early scuba diving, learning to scuba dive. And I quickly found myself rocketing to the surface. And I got to the surface, and a moment later, the dive master showed up behind me. And he was like, "You all right?" And I said, "I don't know. I think I'm going to be sick." And I let out this huge belch, like a sea lion roaring, just, and it went on and on and on and on. And I thought, when is this belch going to end? And as soon as I had let out that giant belch, I sank like a rock, because in every scared breath, I'd been swallowing a little bit of air at pressure underwater. And when it came to the surface, all that air expanded and came out in a huge belch. And then I was negatively buoyant again.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I was curious because, you know, like when you're talking about your background and stuff, it doesn't necessarily track that you would, I mean, obviously there's swimming and stuff. There's a lot of lakes in Minnesota, but it doesn't track that necessarily you're a diver if you're, you know, growing up in and around those lakes.
No, I learned to dive better once I got to Cordova. I retook my dive certification and became more at home in the ocean.
Yeah, because the book begins with you on a dive. And
yes,
and I'm curious in terms of not just the, like for the structure of the book, the opening with that, but also just, you know, the centrality of diving to your research and kind of having to be out there to kind of study behavior.
Yeah. I did start diving with the octopus research. That was the impetus for it. And of course the book, I wanted to open the book with the octopus. And so the book does open there. And that was very deliberate, but I had two facets to my research, particularly early on. And one was diving, and the other was walking the shorelines at very low tides, looking for the shallowest octopus dens that were normally submerged, but were above water during these one or two low tides of the year. And it turned out that the very shallow work in the intertidal was the way to get started, because I could really find the octopuses there. But for the early part of the book, we don't see very many octopuses because I'm mostly encountering them by the signs they leave behind. I'm sort of tracking them, if you will. And it wasn't until later in my career when I had a lot more encounters diving with octopuses.
You write in the book that, you know, the established scientific techniques in behavioral ecology don't transfer well to octopuses. You know, that's your background, is behavioral ecology. Like, did you have to learn a new skill set or just embrace a different way of learning and knowing when it came to studying octopus?
Well, you know, that comes out because when I first, so I had come from my PhD research was on large predators. So I had worked in Serengeti National Park, studying African lions and, you know, doing a little bit of travel with people who were also studying, for example, cheetah or African wild dogs. And in each of those studies, in order to find and, you know, have access to the lives of these animals, the researchers had put radio transmission collars on the animals. And when you put that collar on the animal, then you can use a radio tracking device and you can follow the animal. And so I get up to Alaska and I'm thinking, well, how do I do behavioral ecology on octopuses? And the obvious answer is, well, I'll put radio tags on them. Only radio waves don't transmit through salt water. So you have to use sonic tags. Mm-hmm. All right, fine. But how do you attach a sonic tag to a soft animal like an octopus? You can't put it on externally because the octopus is so flexible, they can just squeeze right out. And so I asked the fisheries biologists in Cordova, and, you know, many of them, to their credit, were very, very skilled at working with finfish. And they said, oh, put a spaghetti tag on them. So I didn't know what a spaghetti tag was, but it's a flexible piece of tubing with numbers printed on it. You slide the tubing into the animal, and it, when you recapture the animal, the number identifies when you last handled it, you know, because you keep records. And so I put some spaghetti tags on octopuses. Well, as you can imagine, this was an utter failure. The octopus can untie the knot. They can slip through the thing. They can bite through the tubing. There was just no way to keep a spaghetti tag on an octopus. And so this is what I meant in the book about sort of established techniques mm-hmm. just don't work. And you have to rethink everything.
You then write that your key into their world would be through their front doors. You know, when you start studying their homes, their dens, like at what point do you realize that? Is that out of like necessity with like failure with these spaghetti tags and things? Is that?
Yeah, that was a desperation move. So you know, I was working with the Alaska natives. The elders were showing me how they harvested octopuses from the intertidal. And, you know, these are wonderful people, wonderful sense of community, just brilliant in the ways that they move through and work with, you know, the environments that they have such long cultural histories with. But the whole notion of stopping to write down data struck many of these people as a very quirky, odd thing to do, laughable. And, you know, so I was just stuck with this question of what kind of record can I obtain from this process of subsistence foraging? They're collecting the octopus, and I can weigh the octopus, tell what sex it is, count how many arms have injuries on them or scars, get a little bit of sense of their life. But other than that, what can I do? And again, this is another one of those instances where traditional techniques don't work. With a lot of animals, if you're going to kill the animal anyway, you cut open its stomach and you say, what are the stomach contents like? But the octopus esophagus is very narrow and it passes through the center of their brain. And so octopuses don't swallow large identifiable chunks of their prey. They mince and grind everything up. And when you look in their stomach, it's a mush. It's like almost a paste. And the bits are very, very small. And I was interested in their behavior. I really didn't want to spend my career killing octopuses and examining the ground up remains of their stomachs. You can learn a lot that way, especially with modern molecular techniques, but it just didn't appeal to me as a way to spend my days. So I began collecting the remains of their food from in front of their dens, because of course they eat crabs and bivalves, which are some of the most heavily armored animals in the sea. And they don't eat the shells, they eat the meat, and they throw the shells outside their doors. And so this became a way where I could see the prey items that they took after the death of the prey items. I could see the size of the shells they came from, what species they were, how big they were, and so on. And that allowed me a great deal of information about what the octopuses were doing.
So this is, I mean, over the course of decades of study, at what point do you decide to write this book? And you know, like, are you just because you've had notes from all your research over the time, it's relatively easy to kind of construct the thread of this book? Or did you find it was difficult to kind of put your head back in 1995 or, you know, 2014, let's say, as, you know, you detail some points in the book?
Right. You know, it was such an, I'd come from Houston. I'd lived in Houston for a year prior to coming to Cordova. And Cordova was such a different world from the way I had lived. It was a fishing village. You know, most of the people I talked to were fishermen. There were boats. My office was right at the mouth of the harbor. To the left of me was a harbor full of working boats. To the right of me was Spike Island and the channel there. And killer whales and stellar sea lions would sometimes swim by my office window. People were of various backgrounds, but you know, I was meeting a lot of Alaska natives. It was just such a different world to me that it seemed surreal. And so the idea of writing a book actually started very early on. Maybe I could write a book. And I played around with it a little bit, but the truth was I had no idea how to write a book. I had no idea how to get it published. And so the notion sort of sat there for a while, but I began writing essays for a little while. I wrote maybe eight essays, and some of the detail from the early years was captured in those essays, although none of them made it into the book as originally written. And I also journaled for a couple of years, so I had journals from that time. And so those helped me when it came time to write the book. But really, I did start writing the book in probably 1996. So the book is 25 years in the making.
Mm-hmm. So if it's that long in the making, at what point do you realize like it's done or you've got to hit publish, let's say?
Well, the book was released yesterday, 2 days ago, on Tuesday, and that was when I sort of thought, wow, it's actually happened.
So even when you sent it off to the publisher, you weren't necessarily like entirely certain that it was done?
There's a whole process that goes on. And so you send it off to the publisher and you cross your fingers that it will be accepted. But the publisher sends it back, and there's, you know, I had a wonderful editor, John Glissman, send it back. And, you know, he said, this is great. Only here's a few thoughts, you know, some of which are like, this chapter didn't work, rewrite it. Which, you know, he was right. And then you go through the copy editing, which is a whole nother phase. Things like the capitalization of the common names of fish. What is the correct way to capitalize the common names of fish? And I hope I got it right in the book, but I spent days studying, trying to figure that out. Then you go through layout. There was work to get the artwork together that my wonderful artist, Laurel, spent ages trying to get the artwork just right. And that went through several rounds of like, how do we submit this so that it prints nicely? Then you get advanced readers copies where you might need to look at them and see if there's any typos, or worse yet, you're not really proofreading them, but you open them up and you find, oh crap, I did that wrong. I wonder if it's too late to change it. You know, advertising, distribution, yeah, there's just so many steps. And so, it was 2 days ago that I was really like, oh wow, it's happened.
Well, it's a 25-year journey, and it's now complete. Many Things Under a Rock, The Mysteries of Octopuses, out through Norton & Co. David Scheel, thanks very much for taking some time to talk about it, and congratulations on the release of the book.
Well, thank you. It was wonderful to speak with you. I appreciate your questions.